Greetings, I'm Keith Klein, the host of the Venture Fizz podcast, where I interview the most fascinating people in the tech scene. This is episode 165, and today's guest is Stella Kim, founder and CXO of MixLab. At home, my family has a Cavapoo who basically rules the roost. She has a big personality and a small frame, and when she is sick, we definitely want to give her the best care possible. In the world where personalized medicine is becoming very real for humans, why shouldn't the same apply for pets? Enter MixLab, the first ever modern compounding pharmacy for animals. MixLab customizes medication ingredients, strengths, forms, and flavors specifically for your pet. The company announced $8.5 million in funding last year, and in addition to providing this very meaningful service, they also have a knack at wowing their customers, which we talk about in detail. In this episode of our podcast, we cover lots of great topics, like Stella's background as a designer and how that shaped her experience as an entrepreneur, what led her down the path of starting MixLab and how she met her co-founders, the details on MixLab and how their business model works, advice for founders on hiring a designer, how a startup should think about branding and packaging, and so much more. Okay, quick side note, there has been a rapidly growing number of pet-related startups, and I've actually interviewed two other entrepreneurs for this podcast that you might want to check out. There's Alex Duvet, co-founder and CEO of Ollie, which is disrupting the pet food industry with a healthier solution, and Jonathan Ben-Simone, founder and CEO of Fi, which has built a really cool smart dog collar. Go to venturefizz.com/podcast to check out all past episodes. All right, without further ado, here's my interview with Stella. Stella, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk a lot about your entrepreneurial journey and kind of the foundation of where you started and user experience, which is very unique. I don't think I've had someone on my podcast yet that has more of a design-oriented background. So I'm excited to talk about that as well as MixLab. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about some great advice that I saw out there when I was doing my research for this interview, where your dad kind of lay down a foundation, which I thought was great advice, of able people versus unable people. So what does that mean?
So there's a lot of advice my father has given me over the years, but this one, the unable people versus able people, really left an imprint on me. He told me that there are two kinds of people in this world. There's the able people and unable people, and it was up to me to decide which one I want to be. So I've interpreted this in many ways over the years, and depending on the situation, you know, I'm faced with, I think about several different things. I'll ask myself, am I strong or am I weak? Am I a fighter or am I a defeatist? Am I bold or am I complacent? And I think it's obvious which ones I chose, but it's these types of questions that have helped me define what I want, understand what's holding me back, and help me figure out how to push myself to overcome it. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it's fear, right? It's this fear that can be crippling, that can hold you prisoner if you let it. And the difference between able people and unable people is how we tackle these fears. And I think a big part of that is how we define failure. So one of the biggest fears as people that really holds us back from achieving is this fear of failure. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's important for people to define what failure actually is and what it means to them. Mm-hmm. So failure to me is never trying or giving up too quickly. Mm-hmm. For most people, failure is trying and having it not work out. You know, it can feel embarrassing or they'll feel ashamed. But to me, you know, that's not failing. That's nothing to be ashamed of. You know, you gave it a shot. That's learning. And it's this type of perspective my father gave me. And it's what's allowed me to be successful. And, you know, there have been so many times where I, you know, quote unquote, failed. Mm-hmm. And it blew up in my face. And I think it's happened to so many people. And there have been some really hard lessons I've had to learn in my life. But it's also the exact lesson that I needed to learn. So, yeah, sometimes or oftentimes, you just have to fail in order to succeed. I mean, mm-hmm. Think of inventors, right? The question is, are you able to get yourself there?
Great, great, great advice. And I think it's, I hope I'm getting this right. You know, Michael Jordan, you know, his famous quote of, you miss 100% of the shots that you don't take.
Yeah. I've said that to some people and they've laughed at me, but they're like, nah, you're right. That's true. Yeah.
So yeah. True. So, well, let's rewind the clock. So talk about your background. So where'd you grow up? What were you like as a kid? What'd your parents do for work?
So I was born in Queens, and then my family moved to Long Island, and I grew up there. If you know me really well, it's pretty obvious to understand what I probably was like as a kid. I was a really, really big tomboy. I grew up with two older brothers and had mostly male friends because there was only boys on my street. I didn't really understand gender roles, and I definitely didn't understand these expectations of me because I was, you know, a girl. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if it's because of all the male influence I had, but I was, you know, I was very athletic. I was really into sports. I was pretty competitive. Mm-hmm. But I was also very creative and imaginative, and I was an avid reader when I was younger. And I think looking back, my favorite things as a child were playing outside, building forts. I was really into building forts, reading, and generally plotting on how I'm going to get back at my brothers for something they did, like destroying the forts. but needless to say, I was very entertained as a child. In terms of my parents, my father is a pharmacist, and my mother was a kindergarten teacher back in Korea. And when my parents immigrated here, they opened up a small pharmacy in Spanish Harlem. My mother couldn't teach when she came here. So besides helping my father with the business, she was very active in the church. She learned English, raised my brothers and I, and somehow also became a traditional Korean dancer and a poet.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm really proud of my parents. I'm grateful for their hard work. You know, their work ethic has really definitely made an impression on my siblings and myself. Mm-hmm. And the sacrifice they made for us. And I'm just so happy that they got their American dream. And I just hope that I can honor them.
That's such a great story. And I think it's interesting, and maybe we'll talk about this throughout the podcast, that what your business is something that you actually didn't want to do, right? You were like, I'm not going to be in the pharmacy industry, right? To be a pharmacist. So yeah. We'll kind of get that into the theme of the conversation here and talk about the company you are building. But so you decided to study abroad, right? Like, so so how did that come about, and how'd you end up in more of the design oriented type of studies?
Sure. A lot of people actually ask me this. So my decision to attend the University of the Arts London can be attributed to Jack Kerouac. Well, maybe my brother, who actually introduced me to Kerouac, but I read a lot of Kerouac and I just wanted to see the world. Mm-hmm. I grew up going to Korea over the summers and volunteering in third world countries. It really gave me perspective and opened up my mind. I really appreciated a hot shower. When I was looking at colleges to apply, I couldn't really find one that really fit me. I didn't grow up thinking I'm going to be this one thing. I think for some people, their path is very clear, and it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
The only thing I did know was that I wanted to do something creative. And I saw college as a time of exploration and a time to learn about myself, what I'm made of, and what's out there in this world. And I saw it as a chance to learn, not necessarily, you know, prepare for a specific job, but to just prepare for adulthood and life. And so it was a gift and a privilege that I decided to take full advantage of. And so, unknown to my parents, I started researching art schools and programs around the world.
Wow.
And once I figured it all out, I literally gave a presentation to my parents. And being the business people they are, we cut a deal. And I held up my end. And so the day after I graduated high school, I got on a plane, went backpacking across Europe until it was time to start my new life in the UK.
That is phenomenal. That's so cool.
It was one of the best decisions of my life. And I'm grateful to my parents for supporting me.
And so what was that experience like over in London?
It was amazing. I mean, schools in the UK, especially the art schools there, they're very international. There are students from all over the world. I know a lot of international students come to America, but I don't think it's quite the same. Mm-hmm. And the way that they teach there, and again, I'm focusing primarily on art schools, is very different to the way they teach here. And I kind of realized that as I was doing my research, and it's because of that, I decided that going there to study was the best option for me. Also, they spoke English, so that also helped. But yeah, I mean, when I first applied to the university, I actually applied as a design candidate. And when I got there, I quickly realized it really wasn't what I was looking for or interested in at that time. And I remembered something someone once told me, that a designer can never be a fine artist, but a fine artist can always be a designer. I'm not sure if that's true, but I believed it to be true at the time. So I figured, well, I can always come back to design, but this is my chance to do something that I won't get to do in the future, potentially. So I applied to the fine art program at Chelsea College of Art and Design, one of the colleges in the university, and they accepted me. And thankfully, it turned out to be the right decision. It allowed me to grow in the way I was hoping to. I found myself very interested in behavioral design and nature versus nurture. And as I was mentioning, when I was researching universities, I come to the conclusion that art schools in the UK are very conceptual. You know, they really focus on concept and developing theories and things like that. And it really, you know, whereas in the States, they really focus on technical. So by focusing on the conceptual, it really helped me develop my mind, because I was able to use it in a way that I never really had before. When I was finishing my bachelor's and thought, you know, about what I wanted to do next, I decided that now I need to grow my technical skills, right? So while continuing to hopefully explore behavioral design, I started researching grad programs that might suit my needs, you know, being able to not only explore behavioral design, but also develop those technical skills that I needed to start venturing into my career.
Yeah, and so then you went to NYU, right?
Yes, so that's when I went to NYU, and I had never heard of a program like this before. My cousin, who's actually an artist in Korea, introduced me to it. And when I looked it up, you know, I was so blown away. So ITP, that's what the program is called. It stands for Interactive Telecommunications Program. Nobody knows what that means.
Right.
But it was exactly the program I was looking for. You know, they really build up your technical skills while stimulating your creativity. It seemed like a program for inventors, innovators, artists, and creators that that use technology as a medium and as a tool. I viewed it as a program for people who wanted to change the world, make the world better using technology. And I felt that I was one of those people, or at least I hoped to be. So I applied and they accepted me.
Awesome. So after you graduated with your master's, what's how'd you get your career started?
In the beginning, I worked at NBC. It's like my first corporate job. I was working on NBC Sports and Olympics and USA. And I was a, what you call a technical producer, I guess, at the time. I did not enjoy the job. It was very corporate. You're like in a cubicle. You have these PC and Excel spreadsheets. And I was like, what am I doing? I went to art school.
Right. Yeah. No, that's not. Yeah.
And so luckily, I was only there for a short period of time because Razorfish contacted me. I guess I had applied to an internship there at some point in my life. And they reached out to me and we set up an interview, and I'm just so glad that they accepted me. They had this nickname for me when I first got there, which I thought was pretty funny. They called me Balls Girl. When I was in grad school, a couple of my classmates and I, we actually created this thing called Testy Touch, and it was an interactive pair of giant testicles that hung from the ceiling. And when you touched it, they would jiggle and they would giggle. And it was my voice that was the audio recording for the giggling. And then they would retract up and retract back down. It was a lot of fun. It was a way for us to learn some mechanical engineering, some physical computing. You know, there's a lot of technical things that was involved. But we had a great time building it. And
that's too funny.
Got a lot of press from it. And Razorfish noticed it, and that's when they reached out to me, actually.
You got a lot of press from it?
Yeah, it was pretty funny. There was like this Australian radio station that did an interview with us. There were like these really wealthy people that wanted us to like hang it up in their apartment. And all these weird things, but we said, you know, we basically said no to all of it.
It's art.
Exactly, it's art. Yeah.
So what did you work on while you were at Razorfish?
I worked on, let's see, I worked on a lot of different things at Razorfish. I wasn't there for, you know, a long time. I was there just over a year. Mm-hmm. But I got to work on Axe, the hairspray brand. It was called Axe Music. They had this like concert series they did with like social media and all this, all these things. I worked on some, let's see, Ford car companies. I think I also worked on Mercedes. I mean, I worked on a lot of big brands. I did a lot of different things. Back then, you know, as a UX designer, you kind of had to do everything. Mm-hmm. Whereas now UX is very siloed, you know, like there's such specific jobs within UX now. But back then, like UX designers had to do everything. So I find it difficult when I'm interviewing UX designers now, because for me, I'm just like, what do you mean you've never done this? Or you don't know how to do this? Mm-hmm. Why did you learn? And it's kind of like, oh, well, I was this specific thing within UX. And so I'm like, but I need someone that can do all of it.
Right.
So working at Razorfish was definitely a great experience. I'm very appreciative of them for giving me a chance. And it really opened up doors for me. It helped me build a portfolio. It, you know, having Razorfish on my resume was made it easier to go on to other jobs. And I noticed that early on, the agency life, this corporate agency life, just is not for me.
Yeah.
But I put in my time. Mm-hmm. Whenever I talk to people about their career and how they're trying to plan it out, I always tell them, like, if you've never worked 1 year in corporate, you know, you should go do that. It's just 1 year of your life. It's not a long time. Mm-hmm. And they ask me why. And I say, because you're going to learn so much there that you won't be able to learn elsewhere. And it'll give you a really good foundation. And it'll also help you build a really good portfolio. And with that, it's basically your ticket to anywhere. So mm-hmm. 1 year, it really isn't that long. It seems like a long time when you're really young, but it's really not a long time.
That's great advice. That's so true. And then from there, you went to Guild Group, or their Park and Bond brand. Yeah.
So I was hired by Guild to come onto the Park and Bond business vertical. And I thought that was really interesting. I was really excited about it because I had this desire to build things and go to a startup. But it was nice because Guild at that time wasn't like, you know, in their true startup phase. They already had like hundreds of employees. And Park and Bond, even though it was like a startup within a startup, they had all the resources of Guild. So, mm-hmm. you know, not much risk there. But the team that I worked with was amazing. And the people I got to meet there, I've, you know, been friends with since then. But what really was great coming out of Guild was the mentorship I got. I don't know how this happened. I'll never be able to explain it. But for whatever reason, there are some people there that took me under their wing and helped me grow as a designer and just as a person, help guide me in my career. And I spoke to one of them recently, and he said that he's so excited for me and MixLab, and he views it as like his own success because he mentored me and helped me grow, and my growth is his growth and my success.
So cool. Yeah. And then from there, you went on to do a lot of independent work. So that can be challenging to be successful as an independent consultant doing user experience type of stuff.
I don't think it is, but I mean, I know people think it is, but I love freelancing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I never had a moment where I thought, oh no, I don't have work coming in, or what am I going to do for money? It was actually the opposite. It was, hey, I actually don't have time, or right. I have something else, or, you know, I feel like there's so much UX work out there that if you want to freelance as a UX designer, you'll be fine. But again, you need a foundation. You know, people have to know that they can count on you. And in order to have that, you have to have a good portfolio and a decent resume before you enter freelance. Yeah. That's why I always say, hey, you want to work on your projects? That's great. Go do 1 year somewhere, build your portfolio, and then go do whatever you want.
Yeah. No, you built the portfolio, and then you were doing so many different things that you knew, like, if a company had a challenge, you knew how to solve that problem.
Yeah, exactly. I got to pick my own projects, which was great because it helped me decide, you know, I knew where my weaknesses were. So it helped me say, okay, there's this offer coming in. I've actually never designed something like this before. I'm going to take this job because I need to learn how to do this, right? I need to push myself to learn how to do this, and they're going to pay me. So it was a win-win.
So what's the hardest part of being a designer? Because here's what's going on in my head. Like, someone's like, this is what I envision, right? And then you kind of listen, and then you kind of create this vision. And then they look at it and they're like, no, that's not it. Like, is that wrong? Or like I would think, because design is such a taste thing, you know, someone has their own personal taste of what they think is good design or not. So what was that like?
I think you have to let go of your ego a lot. And you have to make sacrifices and understand that this is not about you. It's what's best for the business and what's best for the user. Sometimes data does not lie, so use that to your advantage. But also, like, sometimes you just don't have the time, the money, or resources to do exactly what you're trying to do. And in that sense, you have to think about, you know, designing within constraints. And I think if you're a good designer, you can do that.
Yeah.
Designing within constraints is extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And it's a skill that I think you develop over time. But that is the difference to me between a good designer and a bad designer.
Well, let's talk about MixLab. How did you meet your co-founders, and talk about the origination of the idea to, you know, start a company together?
So we were all introduced through my brother and a mutual friend. Starting a company together, I mean, we all had a similar idea or vision, and we all had, you know, solid backgrounds. We all came recommended from someone to each other. And so we kind of just went for it. You know, I don't think it was like this long, drawn out thought process we had about should we work together. It was more like, hey, we want to build this thing. We all have unique skill sets that we can bring to the table. And I think we all have good work ethic, and we're all the type of people that work hard and we want to succeed. So I think because we all had the same kind of mentality about it, we weren't as afraid to like just join forces together.
So how'd you come up with the idea?
Let's see. So I guess I need to go back a little bit. Mm-hmm. So we each had our own reasons for starting MixLab. And for me, I was interested in the future of pharmacies. My father and my oldest brother are both pharmacists, actually. And as I mentioned, we have our own little pharmacy in Spanish Harlem. So somehow, you know, our family is still trucking along, but a lot of other small local pharmacies have died. They've all closed down. But meanwhile, new technology-driven pharmacies are popping up, which I found fascinating. And during a time where personalization is taking over like industries, I thought, why not medicine? Mm-hmm. It's how medicine used to be made, medicine that is 100% customized to you. And so I began exploring personalized medicine in the women's health space, actually. But when I met Fred, we started talking about pets, and it was like a light bulb went on. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, there hadn't been much disruption yet in the veterinary space. And as a designer, I saw it as like a blank canvas. I love pets, we all do. And for whatever reason, the veterinary medicine space was being largely ignored, while at the same time in desperate need for improvement. So the vision was there. We just need to start building it.
Well, it's interesting that the three of you came together and you kind of had this ideas, and then you had skill sets that complemented each other that all kind of came together into forming a company, MixLab. So talk about MixLab. What do you guys do?
Oh, okay. So, well, we're a compounding pharmacy that focuses on custom medication for animals. For us, we really value customer experience. It's really what sets us apart from other companies. And so when we started building MixLab, that was the main, one of the biggest focuses that we put all of our energy into, creating a wonderful customer experience for veterinarians and pet parents.
And how did you actually get started doing that? Like, I mean, you know, your background, you know, your dad has a pharmacy, your brother's a pharmacist. Like, so how did you even get started with this though? It just seems like it's a challenging business to create.
I don't think it's that challenging. I mean, I'm a UX designer. My job is to design complex systems and solve problems and make better experiences for people. I think that can be applied to anything. I think that people don't really understand that. And so when I tell them I majored in fine art and I'm a UX designer that started a pharmacy for pets, yeah, it seems pretty confusing to them. But for me, it seems pretty straightforward. I'm solving a problem. That's my job. And I don't see this as any different, I guess.
So what is a compounding pharmacy? Is that mean that it's personalized drugs? Is that what compounding means in that use?
So a compounding pharmacy is when you make the medication on demand at the right dose and in the right form that is best for you. It's custom medication, basically. And it's especially popular and needed for pets because they come in all different shapes and sizes, which makes it difficult to create a one-size-fits-all medication for them. Also, pets, especially cats, are very finicky. So palatability is a common issue that compounding solves. So I don't know if you've ever tried to give a pet a medication they don't like, but it's a battle and they're very clever. They'll eat around it, spit it out, they'll go hide. The struggle with it is very, very real.
It's fascinating, Stella. So so we have our own dog, a Cavapoo, ironically named Stella.
but that's like a cool dog.
Yeah. So she had some health issues. She was very lethargic. We took her to the vet. They prescribed, I forget what it was. I think it was like an antibiotic or something. And she absolutely lockjawed, refused to take it when we brought her home. Absolutely refused. And to the point where we took her to the animal hospital. Mm-hmm. And they diagnosed her with Addison's disease, which the drug that if she had taken it, it actually might have killed her. Which was like she actually knew that medicine wasn't the right thing. So we just have this memory of her just being like, how did she know? And she was lockjaw. Like she'd never done that before. So, you know, obviously she's on the right medicine now and she is very healthy, but it was just fascinating how she knew. It was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, for us, we work with the veterinarians, you know, we're partners with them. And so as good pharmacists, we review and speak to the veterinarians and think about like, okay, is this the right medication? And if the pet parent feels like there's any issues, then we work with everyone to make sure that we find the right solution.
So as far as the business in itself, like, you know, consumers, they probably don't even know that this is something that exists or that they should even be thinking about, you know, they just assume, you know, okay, just like humans, we just get, you know, our medicines prescribed to us. Same thing with your pet, but there's a lot more that goes into it in terms of what you're actually doing and the market for this. So how did you start to build out that actual, you know, customer acquisition? Was it through, you know, direct to consumer? Was it more through the vet channel? Like how did you start to build the foundation of customers?
Right. So we view veterinarians as partners. And so we definitely spend a lot of time and effort building those relationships to help drive the business. But we've also had pet parents walk into their veterinarian's office and tell them that they better use us for everything and everyone because our service is incredible. Like they walk in with like photos of the packaging and everything. And you know, when that happens, it's obviously incredible. I think the first time it happened, I started crying or something. But at the end of the day, I just think about what everyone's goal is. Our shared collective goal is, you know, between the veterinarians, the parents, and ourselves, the goal is to help the pet swiftly and deliver a great experience when doing so. So you do what you need to do to make that happen. I mean, yes, we focus on the veterinarians, but we also focus a lot on the pet parents as well.
Yeah. Now, you talked about the packaging and branding a little bit. So how did you come up with the name? And then the experience in terms of the packaging is, it's awesome. I mean, it's a very you could tell you took great care in terms of the design of the packaging and what comes into that box. So talk about that experience from the end consumer.
Yeah, so we work with some creative folks that helped us brainstorm a lot of different ideas. I was really excited when we started working on this because I think it's really fun. And I remember when I finally saw, you know, the word MixLab, I think my jaw dropped. There were definitely a lot of bad ideas that were thrown around, but it didn't matter because you only need one good idea. And when you see it, I mean, this is what they say, when you see it, you'll know it. Mm-hmm. And well, we definitely saw it and we definitely knew it. It's a great name that plays on, you know, different things. MixLab is, you know, it's, we're mixing things in a lab, or it could be like a mixed Labrador. And once we had the name, I could kind of see the logo in my head, but as logos always do, it needed the right finesse to really make it great. And all in all, I'm incredibly happy with how it all came out. And I really love the process of getting there.
And then how'd you take the step? Like, so you actually, in, when you get the shipment of the medication, you include a dog toy too. And then it's very personalized on like the packaging around the box and the stickers. There's like, you know, you're actually referencing the animal's name mm-hmm. directly. So how did you come up with that whole experience?
Yeah. So I think the question that we asked ourselves was, how do we want people to feel when they meet MixLab? Mm-hmm. For some pet parents, their first interaction with us is receiving the box. And so when you start thinking about how you want someone to feel, you think about, okay, well, why are they receiving the box in the first place? They're receiving it because their pet is sick, or worse, their pet is dying. And it's a terrible position to be in. And if it was, you know, a friend or family member in that position, you would want to support them and cheer them up. Mm-hmm. And so when we thought about our packaging and branding, we wanted to do what a friend or family would do. You know, we wanted to cheer them up, let them know that they're not alone. It's an olive branch that I think people recognize, and they recognize when you're trying to make a bad situation better or put a smile on your face. And in order to really achieve that as a company or as a brand, it has to feel genuine. And I think in order for it to feel genuine, it has to feel personal. It's letting, you know, that's how you let them know that you care, because it's personalized to you. You know, generally getting medication, it's kind of an awful experience, and it doesn't have to be. Pets, you know, they're smart. And as I said, they'll go hide when they see, you know, the big bad medication has arrived. But with MixLab, parents tell us, you know, they tell us this all the time, how their pet sees our box and they jump for it. Mm-hmm. Their tails are wagging, their tongues are drooling. They cannot wait to get into our box, because to them, our box means a surprise toy and a tasty treat that's actually medicine.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Now, you've also created some of your own branded wellness products, Paw Balm and shampoo. So how did you get into, you know, actually building your own products?
Yeah, so we're a compounding pharmacy. We make custom medication. I mean, actually a large portion of our business, a lot of our orders are actually commercial products that are manufactured. But as a compounding pharmacy, you know, what we focus on is formulation and quality. And I think, you know, Kiehl's, the skincare brand. Mm-hmm. So they were actually a compounding pharmacy before they started their own line of products.
Interesting.
And I think for us, we're able to do something similar. You know, because we formulate and create medicine for acute and chronic diseases, as more and more people get to know us and what we do, rolling out a line of our own wellness products is, I think, a natural next step. You know, to be honest, we've already had parents and veterinarians ask us to make various things. I mean, I have a list already of product requests that I can't wait to do, but for now, you know, we created a couple shampoos with veterinarians, and we also created a paw balm.
Got it. Now, you closed $8.5 million in funding last year, back in June. So, you know, where's the business at now? You know, employees or whatever you can share, and kind of like you shared a little bit of kind of maybe the vision of the future, but where do you see this business going?
Yeah. So right now we're about 40 people and growing. We're actually building out a new lab in LA, And so we're looking to hire there. It's definitely going to be an exciting year for us. We're essentially expanding nationally. And so, you know, I can't say too much, but I'm looking forward to all of the official announcements coming soon.
Exciting times ahead. Stay tuned. So building a business is hard, right? There's a lot of different nuances that make it very challenging. So as you kind of reflect, like what have been some of the more challenging parts of building a business?
Well, fundraising is the worst. The least sexiest thing about starting a company. I mean, some people really enjoy it. Like, I think they get like a high off of it, but it was really hard, but it worked out in the end, and it's been full steam ahead ever since. Hiring is also very difficult. I never knew just how difficult hiring was going to be. And I think the last thing for me, personally, is prioritizing. You know, so I oversee product. That's one of my duties. And there's only so much you can build and so much you can do with the resources you have. And you just really have to focus and pick and choose. And just sometimes it's a shot in the dark, but prioritizing it can be very, very difficult.
Now, we talked a lot about branding and the packaging. So if you were advising another founder on thinking through that, like what advice would you give to another founder on, you know, branding and or packaging?
It's worth the investment upfront because it sets the tone and message for your business. We started with a brand strategy deck and made this ourselves. Some companies hire agencies or other vendors to do this, but even if you do that, I think it's really important to do the first pass yourself with your team. It really, really helped us define our company and get on the same page. It also made it much easier to build the branding and packaging because we had some sort of guideline. My other piece of advice would be to be very clear with your comments when working with your designer. If you like something or don't like something, be prepared to back this up with a good coherent reason as to why. This will help speed up the process and get you to your final design.
So as an extension of that, so my background is recruiting, and I'm mostly focused on product management and marketing, but in my history of recruiting, there was some design UX types of roles, and those were always the most challenging.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are like, hiring engineers is challenging. I'm like, designers is just a whole different ballgame. So what do you think makes a great designer, and what advice would you give to founders on hiring, you know, a designer or maybe a you know, someone who's working independent, whatever the case may be?
So my answer might be overly critical because I'm a designer, but you know, I've interviewed a lot of designers at this point, and there's one thing that I have noticed. Great designers can take one feature and produce a variety of initial ideas on how to design it in just a couple of minutes while coming up with potential new features. They can sketch rapidly and get their ideas across, you know, coherently. Mm-hmm. A user never really has to ask, what am I supposed to be doing here on this page? You know? And lastly, a great designer can get super detailed while still building out and not losing sight of the whole system, you know, the big picture. So if you're a founder looking to hire a designer, I would get a whiteboard, lots of paper, and make sure they can draw a user flow, do rapid prototyping, and adapt to feature changes all right in front of you. Make sure at some point in their career they design a system and not just a marketing page. If they've only designed marketing pages, then they're probably most likely too junior, or they lack the ability to design complex systems, or maybe they were just never given a chance. But you know, for you as a founder, do you want to take a chance on someone who's never designed a system? I don't know. And the last piece of advice I have is, if a designer walks you through their portfolio and they use the word I consistently versus we, depending on the culture of your company, find someone else. You know, good designers that are great to work with are very team oriented. Mm-hmm. They understand what it takes to build something great, and they will give credit where credit is due. Mm-hmm.
That is great, great advice. Yes. Now, What do you seek out as far as inspiration for your designs? Or are there any brands that you admire? What things are out there that are of interest to you?
Let's see. As recently on JetBlue, I find the flight booking process on JetBlue to be quite painless and a nicer experience than other airlines. Mm. It just seems, you know, seamless and direct and easy. As a messaging and communication tool, I use Slack every day, probably not by choice, but I use it every day for work and non-work related conversations. I love their quirky little messages and icons they do. Mm-hmm. And they have these features that make it really easy for you and your team to have like a quick laugh. So I really like that. And I also really like this product called Clubhouse. I'm not sure how long they've been around, but they're a relatively new project management software development tool. Mm. I tried a couple different ones before someone recommended this one to me, and I found it life-changing. Not a perfect software, and there's a lot of features to be, you know, that still need to be built, but I feel like they really put thought into the actual experience rather than trying to cram a bunch of features in without considering the overall UX. Other platforms, you know, they literally gave me anxiety. I would get anxiety, and it felt complicated and old, clunky, and difficult to use. Clubhouse, you know, it makes me feel calm. Like, I like going on Clubhouse, and I feel like I was able to just start using it right away without any difficulty. There wasn't really a learning curve. And that allowed me to focus on what I actually needed to, rather than trying to learn how to set up and use a whole new platform for my team.
Yeah, it's so true. Like, the experience of great products, great product design, like, you know, Canva, the first time someone introduced me to Canva, like, you know, just for, you know, someone who just needs to do basic things that Canva is really good at, it was just like, oh my God, this can actually make me look like a good, you know, create a great image or create a great, you know, marketing piece of material, right? I think it's amazing what they've been able to do with that company. And then we're using Zoom for this. And that's another great one where it's just like, it works and it's calm. It's like, it's not like you got to download this crazy software and then all these features and functionality. It's just, it's software that does what it's supposed to do. It's amazing. Yeah. So,
and it's good quality.
It's great quality. And that's the other thing. It's amazing quality. Yes. Yeah. How about, so you say you like to read, like, any books that you'd recommend, more entrepreneurial type of stuff, or even, you know what, it could be for fun fiction.
I mean, I don't get to read as much as I used to. And I do find, like, I do feel like I generally read more nonfiction books now because, you know, I'm trying to become a better leader and grow our business and all those things. But I actually recently reread a fictional book called The Alchemist. And I didn't remember it very well because it had been such a long time. But rereading it after launching MixLab and as an adult, it was, well, I think it felt different. It just felt much more meaningful reading it now. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend rereading that or reading it for the first time if you haven't already.
What's it about?
It's about this person who is on a journey to, you know, find themselves, you know, to find out what their purpose is in life. And I feel like, you know, that's what we're all trying to do. You know, he's discovering his destiny. And I mean, it's going to sound really cheesy, but I feel like launching MixLab and growing MixLab is almost like my destiny. And, you know, so reading that book, it really, you know, it was very profound.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll have to check it out. What about outside of work? What else do you like to do?
I really enjoy being outdoors in the mountains. I love fly fishing. And being on the river, it gives me a great sense of peace. I also enjoy rock climbing and snowboarding. Unfortunately, it's been tough to do, you know, to do any of those things since launching MixLab. But I think this is the year that I'm going to get to do something, or maybe all of these things. I'm not sure, but either way, I'm really looking forward to getting back out there.
That's awesome. Well, Stella, thanks so much for taking the time to walk us through your background, your professional journey, and of course, what you're up to at MixLab and all the great advice for other founders to follow.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show. I hope you found it useful and entertaining. If you did, please make sure you subscribe so you'll get future episodes. Also, please consider leaving us a 5-star review and share this podcast with all of your friends and colleagues in the industry. It all really helps us out. Last but not least, don't forget to visit VentureFizz.com, the most trusted source for tech and startup jobs, news, and insights. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.